geopolitical commentator and investigative journalist. You're listening to Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to this afternoon's edition of the Pella Nuroff-Taylor show on TNT News Talk. We've got four guests as usual for today. The first one is Ethan Peck. It's increasingly possible to talk openly about the Israeli lobby's power in the US. And Ethan has an interesting story. He's an associate with the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. He's a very pro-Israeli conservative Jew who has a degree in counterterrorism from a Tel Aviv Israeli university. He was astonished to be smeared as an anti-Semite by the Anti-Defamation League. So basically, anything can get you smeared. He contests the fact that he's anti-Semitic. As if we haven't had enough of the thought police, he'll tell us his story as our first guest. Then we've got Pedro Israel Orta, author of The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok, who's going to tell us about his life as a CIA whistleblower. His book says that now here I was, post-Snowden, relying on a system President Obama, Congress, and intelligence community leaders touted as a successful and functional, but was it truly working? My case exposed it as nothing more than a sham. So those of you interested in Snowden and what happened next, do listen to that interview. Our third guest after the break is our old friend Tim Rivers, who's the author of the American Gulag Chronicles, is going to talk to us about the J6 developments and a Supreme Court hearing upcoming next week, which shows that perhaps there is some light at the end of the tunnel for the unfairly jailed prisoners, or maybe not. Finally, we've got Brandon Weichart, or Weichart, a national security reporter and Iran expert who will tell us whether the Iran-Israel conflict will plunge us all into a third world war, and maybe sooner than we think, with the expected Iranian counterstrike on Israeli assets after the Israeli strike on Damascus's and the Iranian consulate in Damascus. There are indeed worrying things going on in the Middle East, but we're going to just pivot back a little bit to Washington and that visit by David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary. He was not welcomed with huge open arms. This was no Tony Blair Clinton or Tony Blair George Bush loving in the glory days of the Atlantic community standing together to fight against tyrants. He slipped in and out without, as far as I can tell, a single mention in the Washington Post or the New York Times. I did a Google News search. I guess they could have stuff in their own archives. Instead, the New York Times headlined its front page with closer ties to Japan in prospect as Biden seeks to counter China, a very obvious indication of America's new foreign policy priorities, or old new, which is China. Ukraine seems to have dropped off the front page or the pages altogether, where it's still a hot topic for the British press. The Washington Post is also less than interested in it, let alone Cameron talking mostly about new developments in the January 6th saga, which shows that the Supreme Court might be passing legislation that might or making decisions that might let some of the J6 protesters out unfairly in jail a bit earlier. We'll be talking to Tim Rivers about that. Anyway, these are my sincere hopes that America is kind of losing the appetite for it. Apparently, Cameron went to see Trump, and there's very, very little about it. There was a positive sort of leak from the Cameron side to Sky News talking about, well, we weren't expecting much sort of thing, but we just wanted to build bridges with Trump. There were some close conservative relations with Trump on the UK side, but not from the British conservative establishment. Cameron notoriously saying things about his misogyny and his lack of stability and so on. And of course, I can't say this often enough, the British were heavily involved in the campaign against Trump post 2016, you know, all this Russiagate stuff had MI6 fingerprints all over it. And then we've got him saying, well, Cameron saying, well, now I think the general tone of it, Mark Stone talking to various people close to the Cameron, talking about, you know, we've accepted Trump sort of thing, sort of paving a way for a resumption of relations. If I were Trump, I'd say, be careful with your friends, as careful as you are with your enemies. Nice talk about the Queen won't cut it. You have to be very skeptical, as you should again be against your adversaries. Meanwhile, Cameron was talking up the usual stuff, the old World War II violin, which the British always deploy on strategic occasions, which was that his fact that grandfather had fought at Normandy, where tens of thousands of Brits, Americans, and Canadians waded ashore to fight tyranny on the continent. the implication, not so subtly, being that Putin is another Hitler. I don't think that's going down too well with America, even though the Biden administration has quite a lot of people of Jewish origin in it. As said, I think they're focused on Japan. I think on the Trump side, there's a lot of skepticism towards the British. But we will see if the British and French now and their new Entente Cordiale will act unilaterally and drag America into the ongoing conflagration in Ukraine. And of course, America, apart from the countering China business, is also very, very worried about the Middle East. And it will. That's what we're going to talk about, I think, with Basil, our political editor, after the very quick break. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk, back after a quick break.
Abroad or at home, this is your news.
By staying silent, we are part of the problem.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the show, Basil Valentine, our political editor. What have we got today? Stuff in the Middle East, I guess, but are we going to wait for that? Are you going to save it for a little bit later and talk about other news first?
I was going to save that for a little bit later because the other story that will never go away in our lifetimes, Pelle, is what? Please fill in the blank for us.
Immigration.
Correct.
Political corruption, I was going to say. Political human
too,
fallibility.
Migration. Yes, the European Parliament is set to vote today on sweeping new laws to overhaul its migration policy. Ylva Johansson. Now, is she one of your Swedish cohorts?
I'm afraid so.
Home Affairs Commissioner, and she's the driving force behind this legislation, which is supposed to be aimed at managing migration in an orderly way. She told reporters yesterday, "We've already taken away a lot of the arguments from the far right by reaching this agreement. I hope we will get the vote because it has been a long journey, a marathon. It will be a really big, big moment for Europe, showing that we can deal with very challenging political issues in an environment that is challenging," she said. The package of laws, however, remains contentious, with critics saying that far from neutralising the far right, the new laws will in effect normalise its arguments and yet do nothing to stop the ever-growing death toll on migration routes to the European Union.
Well, I had a look at that article. I mean, it's like all those loser Swedes who destroyed Sweden and kind of migrated to Brussels, migrated as it were, and are taking up positions there. I mean, these people, I noticed some of the other people quoting, was it Politico article? They're all has-beens or retreads from Sweden. And they're very, very pro-migration. And Sweden has had this very, really population replacement policy. And I think this about the far right, I mean, don't forget, what is now called far right was normal in Europe until the sort of big explosion or the big change in the European elite's view towards migration until about 97 or 2000. It was normal to have a zero net migration. I mean, that was not far right. It was moderate. And then the borders have shifted, the goalposts have shifted for the politicians, but not for the voting public. So I wouldn't call it a far right position to
That's
hold.
That's right. Europe was supposed to be, I remember it being likened to an egg. In other words, a hard shell on the outside, but completely fluid on the inside. That was the dream of the common European home. But of course, the 9/11 wars, the forever wars, the disintegration of Libya, which means that the Sahara Desert can now be traversed by migrants from sub-Saharan Africa far more easily. Still, obviously, a very dangerous route. But that provided a geographical barrier. That's gone. The destruction of Syria, the swingeing sanctions. People tend to forget the West is still imposing, really swingeing, harsh sanctions on Syria, forcing a lot of people into poverty and therefore on the move. And where do they go? They go to the lush pastures of Western Europe, likewise Iraq and Afghanistan, and also just simply from the impoverished countries of North Africa like Morocco, Tunisia and Algeria. You know, lots of Albania, for that matter, coming to Britain. You know, so basically, you know, anywhere where you're worse off, whether you're being bombed to smithereens for spurious reasons or simply seeking a better standard of living, it's quite understandable that people get up and vote with their feet. But it isn't sustainable, Pelle. This is the whole point. I mean, that where the whole far right thing comes into play is that we're not supposed to notice any kind of social or cultural change by mass immigration. That is the sort of taboo. That is automatically deemed racist. If you sort of hold your hand up and say, well, actually, if thousands of these people come here, it won't be the same. Do you see what I mean? It's that's red line. Go on.
No, I think that it's this invade the world, invite the world policy. It's a neocon idea that, you know, you can bomb them in another country because they're led by tyrants, okay? And you've got to get rid of the tyrants. That means bombing their country and killing them. And then when they come into your country, you can't say anything about them. They become like sacred objects. You can't say, well, you know, you're not, people who say maybe there's too many of you. So if you call them something vaguely rude, you, the person, can go to jail for 7 years, but your leaders can bomb them when they're back in their home country. I think it's like very hitting a wasp's nest and opening the window, because a lot of these people, as you, on an individual level, fantastic, or good and bad as people are. But obviously, a lot of them have a very reasonable gripe against the West when they come here because they've been bombed by us. So you can have both a left and a right-wing position on this simultaneously, you know? Or, you know, traditional, what people say.
Exactly. And that position you've outlined, where, you know, the neocon effect is, you know, from my point of view, the polar opposite of what we want to be doing, which is not bombing people in their homelands, but actually enforcing some kind of immigration policy. Well, a lot of people would call this bolting the stable door after the horse is already gone. But this package of laws, which have been on the table, believe it or not, for 6 years, are designed to speed up the asylum processes in the European Union, with decisions on eligibility and forced returns in as little as 12 weeks, something that has prompted Stephanie Pope, the Oxfam expert on EU migration, to say the package had little to do with the human rights of desperate people and more to do with deterrence, detention and deportation.
It's interesting that that Politico article only interviewed people on the left and a whole lot of bloody Swedes, you know, who are all pro-immigration, and it took its slant very much that this was a terrible thing. But I think you haven't talked about the migration skeptics, if we can call it that, say, well, it's not going to go far enough, or it's not going to be effective. And, you know, we don't know if the Poles are going to accept it, or the Hungarians. They might yet throw a spanner in the works, because European policymaking is so complicated, and things usually go back to the Council of Ministers, which I think is a real driving seat, and they're veto topics. So the Hungarians are probably going to say no, and the Poles are going to say no. But I have to say just one thing. I think that the Swedes have been welcoming this because some countries have taken very much more than their quota. And so Sweden's now led by an anti-immigrationist notionally. They're sort of saying, well, the Poles have to take some now. But I mean, The skeptics in Sweden say, well, you can say all you want to the Poles. They're not going to do it. Why do you take in all these migrants, the highest proportion in Europe, and then just say, well, it's the Poles' fault for not taking more? That won't wash. Just stop them. I mean, you're not going to take migrants in and then hope that they're going to somehow migrate to Poland or Hungary. It ain't going to happen. So, we'll see what happens with this, you know. But as you said, it's ahead of the European elections, where the populists, or whatever you want to call them, are going to make major big time advances, and it's going to be over the immigration issue. So it's interesting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Britain, of course, no longer in the European Union. We stand slightly outside this. But the numbers, that's the thing. It, you know, the argument is, well, you know, if we accept this number of people, then perhaps that'll mean a stop or something, that there's somehow a finite number of people that would like to migrate to Northern and Western Europe. And that simply isn't the case. The population of sub-Saharan Africa goes up by over 100,000 souls every single day. There is quite simply no limit to the number of people who would rather live in Central and Western and Northern Europe than live where they do at the moment. So we either sort of accept the principle that we have borders of some description for one reason or another, or we don't. I've heard people say, well, we should just sort of regard us all as fleas on a dog's back, and does it really matter where the fleas are, you know? We're all living on this dog's back. But I mean, it's a recipe for chaos. Open borders.
There is a case that you did philosophy at university. The guy called John Rawls has said, we were all born, we don't know where we're going to end up. So let's assume that you don't know where you're going to end up and distribute immigration. Because it is, of course, unfair that you're born in Africa compared to being born. We have won the golden ticket in Europe. But that said, I mean, that's a philosophical question and a realistic question. We've got to be realist as well. So I do understand the moral case for open borders. Anyway, Basil, we'll carry on. We'll talk about Israel, I guess, in the second hour. And we've got some guests who are very interested and hot on the conflict there. So thanks a lot, Basil. We'll talk to you in the next hour. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We've got our first guest.
TNT's James Freeman.
The Biden administration is planning to use Florida as a leading processing site for more than 320,000 illegal migrants that the administration is flying into the country. Yes, this apparently is all about solving the problem at the southern border, as Biden's solution to the problem is to fly illegals directly into the country on direct flights. Yes, that's right. In order to reduce pressure at the border, the Biden administration is going to fly illegal migrants into America, and the plan is to send more than 320,000 of them to Florida for processing.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon. We are very pleased to have with us Ethan Peck, who's an associate for the National Center's Free Enterprise Project, the conservative movement's only full-service shareholder activism and education program. Before pursuing a career in political advocacy, he worked as an audio engineer and music producer in New York City, as well as an editor for the Jerusalem Post in Jerusalem. He credits both experiences instrumental to his eventual departure from the left. He holds a master's degree in counterterrorism from the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, and he's going to talk about his article, "The ADL Smeared Me with Anti-Semitism, But I'm Jewish." Welcome to the show, Ethan. So I guess not too many people with master's degree in counterterrorism from Herzliya and editors for the Jerusalem Post have been called anti-Semitic. What did you do wrong in their eyes?
I was on the right and I said the word globalism.
Right.
That's basically all I did. What I do is I file share, me and the organization I work for, the National Center for Public Policy Research, we file shareholder proposals at corporate shareholder meetings to try to pull corporations back to fiduciary duty and back to neutral and away from politics. We don't even push them to the right. We just try to get them out of the left. In one of our shareholder proposals that went after corporate funding of the World Economic Forum, we used the word globalist, and apparently that's a cardinal sin according to the woke ADL.
Just before we launch into that, can you just give us some examples of how corporations have turned to the left? What are the bad things that they're doing that you need to pull them back from?
Yeah, well, I'm sure a lot of people have already heard this term, but ESG, it's more popular in America, but ESG it stands for environmental, social, and governance. It's basically just code for Marxism. So corporations are now doing what the government can accomplish, and the government's doing what the corporations can accomplish. So it's very fascistic. They're kind of working together. And this sort of public-private partnership, which is exactly what the World Economic Forum pushes, is a way for corporations to use shareholder money to push a left-wing agenda, like LGBT issues, support for trans and children, equity, diversity, equity and inclusion, hiring by race, sex and orientation, pushing net zero policies and demonizing reliable energy, all this from the corporate side. Citizens want to debate this in the public, we can do that, but it doesn't belong in the corporation.
Well, I'd be surprised. I think that I was talking to another guy about that, and the sheer power of some of these investment companies and corporations and hedge funds and whatever, BlackRock. I don't know much about finance, but basically, these guys are using investors' money, pensioners, people with two-parent families, sort of thing, conservatives, normal people living out in what it flyover land or whatever, and kind of using their money to arrogate themselves power, and they're not held accountable for it. We observe the sort of political scene very relatively closely, on both sides. But the corporate scene, the shareholder scene, is something we don't know much about. So pensioners, or people who've invested their pension funds, they don't know where this pension money, their money, is being spent on projects they don't support at all. And you're kind of, that's your project. That's what you're trying to do. You have an eye on that and you're trying to drag them back. And for that, you were called anti-Semitic because you used the word globalist. And that's supposed to, why is that supposed to be anti-Semitic? Can you explain?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you got it exactly right. That's the prime violation, using other people's money. So that's exactly what BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street and ISS and Glass Lewis and Fidelity and Invesco, that's what they get so wrong. Because like I said, people should be able to hold opposing beliefs. They do. We argue them out in Congress, but to use other people's money, 70% of people don't support trans and kids, but then 100% of the money, their money, gets used by corporations to fund organizations that push this. That's not right. And so we use the word globalist, honestly, because in the shareholder proposal in that we put forward at the company, we couldn't just say World Economic Forum, because if it's too specific, the SEC shoots you down. And so we just kind of use a more blanket statement. So we just said globalist organization to be, more neutral and encompass not just the World Economic Forum, but the Council on Foreign Relations, UN. But we then tailored it towards the World Economic Forum afterwards. That's just because of the way the SEC rules work. And we said globalist because we meant globalist. They are globalists. I didn't mean Jew, but there are people, far right lunatics, that use the word globalist very often to mean Jew, but that's not how we used it. And this idea that a few bad actors should make some words off limits because they use it as a dog whistle, it shouldn't be mean. We're not using it as a dog whistle. We meant globalist, not Jew. I'm Jewish.
I agree. We'll talk a bit more about that, what the ADL's motives were, but I just want to, you're now going to do a public service for me, because I use the word globalist all the time, but I don't quite know what it means. I mean, I kind of use it. It's the advantage of it is precisely because it's not, I don't mean to knock the Jews or anything. It's just that it's a kind of fuzzy definition. It's a kind of our enemies. So we're playing back. They call us far right or whatever. I'm not far right by any means, but it's a kind of fuzzy definition. But what sort of things do globalists believe? I mean, we're engaged in a joint endeavor here to tell our viewers what a globalist is.
Yeah, this is a good endeavor. So I think a globalist is somebody that doesn't believe necessarily in national sovereignty, or not strongly. So enforceable borders is something that a globalist might oppose. Another thing that a globalist really values is the partnerships and of different nations with different corporations all working in tandem but the issue with that is look at the UN. They put forward the 17 sustainable development goals, and they have other countries sign on to it, but I don't agree with 90% of the stuff in there. And so why should some bureaucrat from Zimbabwe or Iceland have any say over what I do in New York, they're not my representative. So that's taxation without representation kind of thing. That's the globalism that I oppose. And then working with the interests of multinational conglomerate corporations together, that's what I mean by globalist. And by the way, this has nothing to do with Jews or Judaism. Some of the people, a few people might happen to be Jews, but and some of the crazy, really far right people might try to notice patterns in some stupid way. But that's okay. That's not what
Ethan,
we're doing.
We just could go into a news break, a 60-second news break, and we'll carry on this very theme because it's very interesting. Yeah. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We'll be back after a news break.
Great news.
The news.
We have news.
Great news.
Great news. Great news.
Great news, my friends.
Yeah. Listen.
TNT Radio News.
This is Jason Olborn with your news headlines. The Turkish government has imposed export restrictions on Israel, covering 54 product categories in response to the Gaza war. More than 100 people have died on a capsized ferry escaping a cholera outbreak off Mozambique. A CIA and former FBI official has admitted in an undercover recording that the FBI can jail anyone. Gold and silver prices continue to enthrall investors, with gold breaking another peak at US $2,356.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Okay, welcome back to the show. We've got Ethan with us, who's talking about how he's fighting against woke corporations and that he was smeared as an anti-Semite for it because he thinks by the ADL, no less. And we just talk about globalism. I guess because, Ethan, the background is I've had this show for several months and we talk about who runs the world. I mean, that's the essential central question of almost every guest. And so just for reference, because to give people background, some people think it's the British Empire. Some people think it's the American Empire, Washington, basically, through its 800 military bases. And then there's a third strand, I would say, which is the globalist strand, which says it's the UN and international corporations working in tandem. OK, but we'll go with that. I mean, they could all be true. I don't want to, you know, I think we should have these people facing off against each other to find out which of the point is you were called a believing Jew and a conservative who's trained in Israel. You were called an anti-Semite by the ADL for this. The ADL, Anti-Defamation League, they put up a blog naming you, and despite you writing to them, they haven't taken it down. What's their purpose here? Is it accident, or are they kind of targeting you? Have they gone too far? What's going on? What do you think their psychology is? What are they?
I think it's a pure smear campaign because, first of all, I do think that it's possible. You know, there are Jews out there that hate themselves for being Jewish, that are self-hating Jews. Those people exist, unfortunately. But I mean, I'm very pro-Israel. Like, I know that's even taboo nowadays on the right. Unfortunately, there's a lot of crazies on the right too and on the left. But I'm very pro-Israel. I have family in the IDF. I take no shame in it. I am practicing Jew to a big extent, and so I wrote to the ADL telling them all this. I outlined how so much of my life has been dedicated to Jewish causes, and they didn't even answer me. And then recently we also had another smear by NBC, which smeared us as, you know, anti-LGBT. So it looks like we're facing the some of the most powerful people in the world, like BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, World Economic Forum, and we go up against them on a daily basis. To think that they wouldn't try to smear us in some kind of ways, in various different ways, is naive. And so we're getting some smears, and the more successful we are, we're going to get more smears.
So do you think that, I mean, are these guys funding ADL in some way?
I don't know who funds ADL. I don't think so. I don't think that there's any sort of relationship between the World Economic Forum and ADL. I would highly doubt that.
But BlackRock, say?
I don't like to speculate. Yeah. I'm really not much of a conspiracy theorist. Like, I don't like to speculate. I don't know who funds the ADL. I think it's probably like private donors, and so I think it's because they're woke and because they're leftist.
So on a personal level, you feel like you've been stabbed in the chest by this, because I mean, this could be nobody's more pro-Jewish than you are, pro-Israel, and yet here they are calling you an anti-Semit. I mean, talk about abandoning your allies. This is not a smart move by ADL, is it?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say necessarily call them my allies, because they don't even really push they don't push pro-Israel or pro-Jewish values in a full way. They hide behind like a patina of being just an anti-Semitism organization, and what they really do is push wokeness. And so they're far from my allies.
Mm. So what do you hope from them? I mean, what would satisfy you? Because they've still got this blog post up. They smeared you. You're doing great work fighting, this leftism, or this globalism, as you say, which takes away, basically removes the democratic choice from the public and puts it in the hands of corporations and bureaucrats for values that most people don't share. That's what you're doing. That's good. And they're trying to take you down on this anti-Semitism smear, which millions of others have been caught up in anyway. Where do you want to go next with this?
We're happy to, expose the ADL's bias and nonsense. And we're get back on track to doing what we're trying to do and go after corporate wokeness and stakeholder capitalism and exactly the paradigm that you just outlined so perfectly. And just let it roll off our backs and onto the next thing. And I'm sure there'll be another smear.
So where can we find your stuff then on the internet?
Yeah, so you can go to freeenterpriseproject.org to read about us. And we actually, if you're in America and you own your stockholder yourself, you can go to proxynavigator.com and we'll actually help you vote your shares in line with our recommendations. We'll sift through all the shareholder proposals, all the board members at every company, and we have recs that are anti-woke and just neutral. And so if you want that, proxynavigator.com.
Proxynavigator.com. That sounds like it's an excellent project for getting your will heard and not the faceless blind corporations who don't care about what normal people think. Excellent. Thank you very much, Ethan. Good luck with your projects. And we'll have you on again. Thank you. Have a good afternoon. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. And we've got our new guest coming up very shortly after a break.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mom a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, great idea.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with Elaine.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options. Potential tax breaks.
Boom.
This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Discussing national and international issues. You're listening to Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon on TNT News Talk. So we're very welcoming here of Pedro Israel Orta, who's the author of The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok, the memoir of a CIA whistleblower. He's a Miami-born son of Cuban immigrants who fled Fidel Castro's communism, and he brings his 18-year experience as a Central Agent Intelligence Agency veteran to his memoir, having served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other locations in the Middle East. Working on worked on exposing issues of abuse of power, which led to his own retribution and termination, despite earning 8 exceptional performance awards for his contributions to US national security, mostly in counter-terrorism operations. Welcome to the show, Pedro.
Thank you, Pelle, for having me on your show this day.
So we were sort of all hoping after the Snowden affair about 10 years ago that the CIA would be cleaned up. Obama seemed to make promising noises and everything was good and hunky-dory. But you're sort of saying with your experience, it hasn't worked out so well. And you put this in a book. Tell us about your book and tell us what you're appalled by and what causes you to whistleblow.
Well, the broken whistle, the process to blow the whistle effectively and be protected, is completely broken the intelligence community. Post-Snowden, you know, they cried, they claimed, they shouted, we have whistleblower protections. Blow the whistle, use the authorized means, methods internally to disclose waste, fraud, abuse, so forth. The reality is, I being post-Snowden whistleblower, I used all those internal channels. In my case, there were some serious issues in a war zone base. I was the deputy chief of base, working for a chief of base. Our lives were being endangered. The mission wasn't being met. The base turned into a social club on steroids. I blew the whistle internally, and I received a crap load of reprisals, career damaged, literally chased out of the CIA. I hunkered down, take refuge in the office of the Office of Inspector General for the Intelligence Community, known as the IGIC. In my capacity there, we work on an evaluation to review the implementation of those whistleblower protections that I was supposed to have and others are supposed to have. It turns out that it's just pretty ink on paper, worthless laws that are unenforceable, and more importantly, they have no desire to enforce. Mm-hmm. One thing led to another in that evaluation, and the team stood fast, holding its ground on what we found. But the senior level management at that time was trying to push a narrative that there were whistleblower protections, which the part that was true was on paper there was, but the implementation, mm-hmm. no. So it turned into another round of reprisals against me, got sent back to the CIA. Now I'm blowing the whistle internally to Director Pompeo through his number 3. Then I'm blowing the whistle directly to the Director of National Intelligence, Daniel Coates, and his deputy, Susan Gordon. And what happens? The CIA basically sends the Office of Security like a big bad bully, like a mafia enforcer, to threaten me. Be happy you have a job. Literally is what they tell me. And when I don't comply, they send the enforcer on a hit job with a surveillance op and be on the lookout list, deny me entry of building, and put me through the personnel evaluation board, which is basically a kangaroo court, which took my clearance away and fired me. And in this entire process, not a single congressman came to help. So the bottom line is the whistle is broken. There are no whistleblower protections. It's all basically just a sham. And when the Ukraine whistleblower came forward using the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act, that same process I used, the CIA told me, we don't pass everything to Congress. The IG himself refused to process my disclosures. They did nothing to push my disclosures forward. And when I finally used the process again, because they told me to use it again, they end up telling me, oh, you're fired. You can't use the process. So
we'll go back to your case in a moment, because I think this is Ukrainian whistleblower. Is that guy Vindman?
Vindman, Alexander Vindman, and Eugene Vindman. There's two of them.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So I'll just, because me as a kind of guy on this side of the pond, what I say is what the average person here knows about. So, and you will work from that. So it's kind of what we know is that for the anti-Trumpers, he was a whistleblower who blew the whistle on the lunatic Trump and his dysfunctional White House or whatever. But for those of us who follow a little bit of the American news, but not as much as, or a little of the anti-establishment news, we know that this was a kind of setup, because this was a Ukrainian migrant or something who got a high position in the White House and was basically using the Whistleblower Act to conduct some kind of private vendetta against Trump, elected president, which is not exactly what the Whistleblower Act was for. Is that something approximating to the truth?
That is exactly correct. He is a Ukrainian background, was working Ukrainian issues. When Trump issued the phone call trying to get some policy issues, you know, looking into the Biden corruption, for example, that was the gist of it. Vindman did not like the fact that Trump was going to withhold aid from the Ukraine. He called it an illegal act. Then he started using the process. He knew he couldn't file a Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act disclosure since he was not an Intelligence Community employee. So he talked to one of his Intelligence Community contacts, believed to be Eric Sirumella, who made a secondhand disclosure. And that started the process to basically impeach President Trump on what the Department of Justice in the United States said was not an Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act disclosure. So the claims didn't even fit the law within the parameters of blowing the whistle at the CIA or the intelligence community.
And I remember, I think didn't the Washington Post use or call him a whistleblower. And I thought that's not a whistleblower because for a while, again, I'm just kind of talking from memory, there are all these, I mean, the Washington Post, of course, in most Europeans' eyes is the paper of impeccable rectitude that toppled an evil president. I mean, many of us know better, but that's the old Nixon Watergate thing. And here they were again, the new Watergate journalists, the new Bernstein and Woodward, using whistleblowers inside the CIA to bring down an evil president. But of course, these whistleblowers just sounded to me like leakers who had a gripe against the president and call themselves whistleblowers to sort of impose this beautiful mantle of being a truth teller when they were just intelligence operation takedowns of their own president, you know, whereas you're a real whistleblower, you were demonized for it. I mean, so in a way, it's been totally turned upside down, this whistleblower protection program, hasn't it? And the whole concept of whistleblower. Yeah.
Essentially, don't you dare blow the whistle on our dirty laundry inside the intelligence community, because if you do, we will destroy you. But meanwhile, go ahead and use these whistleblower process to target our nemesis, our enemy, President Trump. Yeah. See, the intelligence community sees Trump as a threat because he realizes that we have a deep state run amok. And what we mean by that is a national security establishment, a national security bureaucratic state, where it has so much power that it literally can't dictate to the president what it wants done and what it does not want done. And if a president does not comply with its wishes, they will see to it that they will find a way to either go around that president, destroy that president, or get that president out of the way. And this actually goes back decades. These problems have been ongoing in the United States as far back as basically World War II, the Cold War, you know, 50s, 60s. The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot is an excellent book that gives the reader some excellent background on how this behemoth of a bureaucracy grew in power to basically be more powerful than a president.
I want to ask you, because there's a piece of news that's out on Twitter which relates exactly to your experiences or your insights into the deep state. It's a website called Sound Investigations, and they've gone around recording CIA officers undercover and sat with the guy in a restaurant and he was a bit drunk. You can find it on the Sound Investigations. You just type that into X and you'll find it. But he says, this CIA officer says, we practice entrapment a lot. We call it a nudge. We can put anyone in jail in situations by putting them in situations, but they have no choice to act on their impulses. So they can put on, they talk about putting pro-lifers in jail. And then we put out a fake post out there and we know about your history. We know how to put a fake profile on how to get them. Anyway, I'm quoting directly, I was just typing it down. But basically, it's shocking. I mean, they put out fake news in the media. They G people up and they get people to do illegal things. And then they jail them under. And then this defamation case, I can't remember now. Do you have any thoughts about this? I mean, they're basically acting completely illegally, like a political police force to get at right wingers, people they call right wingers.
I can tell you my firsthand experience dealing internally with the CIA, how they did a similar operation against me. The Office of Security called me an insider threat. They send two investigators to talk to me, the threat management unit. And I'm sitting down with two, you know, law enforcement investigators. And it's a lengthy conversation. At the end of that conversation, both of them said, "You are not a threat. What can we do to help you?" Well, miraculously, whatever was discussed in that meeting got perverted, twisted, turned into what I did not say. And then I'm dealing with security leaders at the topest level, falsely accusing me of saying things I did not say, which was the predicate they used to send the enforcer against me. That's just my internal case. So entrapment ops, that's what it's called. Look at the General Flynn, Michael Flynn case, how the FBI interrogated him under an interview request that was a benign interview, and they basically flipped it against him, perverted his words, and accused him of perjury when he did not lie. So these are common tactics that are used within law enforcement and sadly within the intelligence community. And it boils down to one key element, the lack and the failure of congressional oversight.
Justice Flynn case, could you just give us a bit more meat on that? I remember that, but how did exactly, because Flynn was basically an incoming national security guy, as I remember, and he was going to talk to the Russian ambassador, was it? Which is a kind of normal thing you do, talk to everyone when you're coming into power in 2016 and 17. And they'll kind of make it out that he's some kind of Russian spy or something. But in what way did they pervert the interview? Do you remember?
What happened here was, you're right, as a National Security Council director designate, it is normal for such a person to have contact with foreign country leaders. And that's what he was doing. But what was going on was they were using these FISA, these intelligence capabilities, to monitor the conversations he was having. Instead of listening at just the Russian stuff, they were looking at his stuff. And in this particular case, Obama and General Flynn, actually, it goes back prior to that incident where he was ousted from the director of intelligence because he would not toll the company line. He would not agree to give false information to the public during his leadership at the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. So they kicked him out, basically. They ordered him to be retired early as a three-star general. So from that point forward, he was an enemy of Obama. Obama did not like him, and he did not want General Flynn to be the National Security Council director. And he warned Trump about it. So they used the FBI to target him. And you're right, the genesis of it, or the gist of it, was a conversation he had with the Russians. And they accused General Flynn of lying about what he discussed on that telephone call. When he met with the two FBI agents, he, you know, told them what he recalled to have stated on that phone call. And what happened was, well, they had a transcript. And they basically flipped it around and said, "You lied to us in that interview. Because you lied to us in that interview, you have perjured yourself. You have committed an illegal act of lying to law enforcement officers." And they used that to basically entrap him, to falsely accuse him. And it led to basically him having to do a plea deal, agree to it. Because if you ever get into a case like that one, it can take hundreds, if not millions of dollars to defend yourself. The state is so powerful, and everything that they throw at you will bankrupt you. In order to save himself, he pled guilty to a lie against him, and there was another factor involved. They threatened to go after his son, Michael Flynn Jr. Had a baby. And they were going to do an operation to also get Michael Flynn Jr. in jail. And at that point in time, Michael Flynn, the father, stood up for his son and said, "I'll plead guilty. Don't touch my son." That's just how dirty these law enforcement agencies
can be. It sounds incredible. But I just, an obvious question is, maybe he was put off by the fact that they were going to go after his son. But couldn't he just say, "Well, this is what I told you because it's recorded. And oh, that's a transcript of the conversation. That's more or less the same thing." Or did he kind of forget and say the wrong thing when he's recalling it? And then they pulled up the transcript and said, "No, you said something different."
In reality, he told them the truth.
Yeah, right. But they lied and said the transcript said something else. So it's just a straight out lie.
This will come out later. Somebody at the FBI actually had the audacity to take that interview and twist his words, pervert his words, said something he did not say.
Right.
So they actually crafted that he lied when he did not lie.
Right. That's incredible. And of course, then he didn't want to go up against the state because it cost him millions of dollars and it caused endless trouble. And so this was a kind of a white knight in shining armor who's going to reform the deep state under Trump. And this was already sabotaged even before Trump came to power. We've only got 2 minutes left. So what do you think the prospects are for Trump reforming this? What's the situation like going forward? Because I heard from a guy yesterday said, well, Trump's going to put in big reforms. But of course, the deep state knows that. So are they going to try and stop Trump from becoming president?
They are already trying to stop by passing laws, executive orders that would forbid Trump or any president from terminating, firing any civil bureaucrats. So the key two factors here are, first and foremost, Trump has got to ensure that he puts in people who are strong enough to shape and reform these agencies.
Okay. People are strong enough. Okay, so we got to terminate there. Thank you very much. We'll have you on again. It's a brilliant talk, and we highly recommend your book. Pedro Israel Orto, who's written The Broken Whistle, tells you the truth about the rotten CIA and why Trump needs to reform it. Thank you very much, Pedro. Have you on again. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT. Thanks.